This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. We've got a couple of guests tonight that I think everyone will be fascinated to hear the story of: William Thorpe, the son of the famous athlete Jim Thorpe, and Robert Wheeler, the author of Jim Thorpe, World's Greatest Athlete. And that's really what Jim Thorpe was. Jim Thorpe, between the year 1913 and 1919, played professional baseball for the New York Giants, the Cincinnati Reds, and the Boston Braves. In 1915, he began playing professional football with the Canton, Ohio Bulldogs. He went from there to winning the pentathlon and the decathlon in the 1912 Olympics in Antwerp, Belgium. In 1913, Jim Thorpe lost his medals when it was discovered that he had originally played professional baseball. His medals were reinstated in 1983. But we have another story that we're here to talk about, Jim Thorpe, and that's what the nature of the book that Bob wrote, Bob Wheeler. Hello, Bob, and hello, William. How are you?
Esma, how are you tonight?
Wonderful, thank you. Thank you both for being with us this evening.
I
would like to introduce William. William, can you tell us a brief history? Obviously, being the son of Jim Thorpe, there's a lot of importance to that title, based on your father's history and, of course, your own. Tell us something about your father. Tell us what you remember about him.
Well, I remember, you know, my father is being a happy-go-lucky individual that just enjoyed life, basically. He was a great outdoorsman. He enjoyed hunting and fishing. Take us boys out, my older brother and myself, take us out coon hunting at night. This was out in California around the Santa Ana River. And also he'd take us fishing down on the piers off of the coast of California. He'd hook up a line for my older brother and a line for me, and we'd snag for bait for him to fish with. But Dad was just a real happy-go-lucky individual that enjoyed life. He just enjoyed everything that he would do. He's just there wasn't much that he couldn't do.
Do you remember what were some of the feelings that you had surrounding your father's abilities in sports, Bill?
Pardon?
Your father was a great sportsman and a great athlete. How did you feel about him when he won the Olympic medals and things like that? What went through your mind?
Well, I was born in 28, so I wasn't able to, you know, see anything in these earlier days. But to have accomplished what he accomplished in the Olympics, the only individual to win the decathlon and pentathlon events in the world, was just a great honor and for me and for the rest of the family, naturally, to have him have won all the programs. He tried real hard to accomplish all of these things, and then had the misfortune of having them taken away from him.
That must have been terrible for your father, considering all of the work that it would take to be an Olympic award winner.
Yes, it was. He was upset about it, But it was something that that he said many times, that it's something that they cannot take away from him, the events that he participated in and the wins that he made. And winning both of the decathlon and pentathlon is something that will, you know, stand for life.
Now, he's also a member of the College Football Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and the Track and Field Hall of Fame, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes. He played football at Carlisle, naturally, to gain his fame. And then he went on into professional football and played for the Canton Bulldogs out of Canton, Ohio. And then he also had an all-Indian team that was called the Boorang Indians.
Oh, then, really? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Baseball, when he went into baseball, he played for the Giants and I think Boston and Cincinnati.
That's wonderful. Now, your family heritage, is that of the Sac and the Fox Indian?
Yes, Sac and Fox Indians from out of Shawnee, Oklahoma. That's the tribe that we're registered with.
Okay. And now starts the controversy, unfortunately. Now, I know that, Bob, you wrote this book to highlight some of the events that has led up to the fight for Jim Thorpe's body, and that, in fact, is what it's become, has it not?
That's correct, Basma.
Now, can you tell
us... It's in litigation currently... But the family of Jim Thorpe and the Sac and Fox tribe, his tribe, have made an appeal to the town of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, for the return of Jim's remains to his native soil. That was his wish expressed to his children. That is the belief of his tribe, and that is the current state, that, as you just mentioned, that's ongoing as we speak.
Now, perhaps you can enlighten us, Bob, because you have written this this book, and I'm sure that this has been very important to you in revealing the entirety of the story of what has led up to this. Why is it that he wasn't buried in Oklahoma in the first place?
It's kind of a convoluted story, because, but very briefly, and Bill, why don't you were there, you were present for the actual Indian burial after Jim passed, and
we
might be good if you mention what that was like.
Yeah, we had two ceremonies that day. Earlier in the day, he had a Catholic program that we went through. In the evening, we went out for the Indian burial. And this is a program that is established to send his body and spirit to the, I guess you'd say, happy hunting grounds. But during the program, burial, we were having a farewell luncheon, or dinner, actually, for him. And during this dinner, Patsy... Dad's third wife come in with the police and a mortuary people, and took his body from the program and took him into his body into Tulsa and put him in the mortuary there in Tulsa. But I mean, it was a ceremony that was broken up and never completed, and that's one of the things that we want to do when we do get his body back, is to go through this program to send him to the happy hunting grounds.
Well, let me ask you, gentlemen, when he died, where did he die, actually?
He died in Lomita, California.
Mm-hmm.
And
was his body...
At that time, the Governor Murray of Oklahoma, had promised that he would provide a memorial for Jim that would be comparable to the memorial to the other great native Oklahoman, in his words, Will Rogers. Mm-hmm. And he had a meeting with President Eisenhower. He had a meeting with Ross Porter, who was the editor and owner of the Shawnee New Star newspaper. And they formed this committee to set this up. And the governor unexpectedly vetoed the appropriation, and that precipitated Mrs. Thorpe's taking Jim in the middle of the burial ceremony that Bill described. That was in 1953. And then in 1954, after a meeting with Bert Bell, then the commissioner of the National Football League in Philadelphia, she was despondent when he was unable to raise money for a memorial. She was trying to find a memorial to honor her husband. And
So her intentions were honorable.
The two small towns in Pennsylvania, Mauchunk and East Mauchunk, combined and offered Mrs. Thorpe the changing of their names to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, and to have his body buried there. And that's historically how all that came about, and that was in 1954. But
so
as I said earlier, Bill has indicated that it is Jim's wish, and it is the wish of his tribe. But, Bassam, I think it goes beyond that. It goes into the spiritual realm, into the religious realm, and the history that I have done on American Indians, it's unanimous that there is this desire, this spiritual desire, to be buried in one's native soil. And hopefully this argument, this plea, will not fall on deaf ears. And indeed, as we speak tonight, my son's a senior at MIT, and his friends are putting together a website, literally as we speak, that will be entitled JimThorpeRestInPeace.com, because people of all ages, Bill and I met with Wayne Newton 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and he told us, he said, if you can get the word out to the people of this country, and indeed the people around the world, what is at stake, that this man's spiritual beliefs means that his soul is forever wandering and is not at peace. He said that if you can get this information out, and even the attorney for the Sac and Fox told me the same thing, that if people will hear this plea from Bill Thorpe and his brother Dick and the tribe, then I think that the people of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, the citizenry primarily, would be moved to do the right thing. And I'll say here tonight, I've never said this publicly, that if there's anything I can do, if anyone is listening to this program in Pennsylvania, anything that I can do to set up some type of a program, some type of a memorial to Jim, some type of a festival, some type of a ceremony, just anything that would accommodate the feelings of the people in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, I'll say here tonight, I'd be willing to do that.
Well, you know, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there has been no ill intention on any of the participants, whether it was Jim's wife, the city of Jim Thorpe, or the Sac and the Fox and the family. So it's just a matter of looking into a spiritual resting place for Jim at this point?
That's absolutely correct. Bill's younger brother, who recently passed, Jack Thorpe, did extensive interviews, television, internet, newspaper, radio, and has never, and nor has Bill or anyone from the Thorpe family, ever expressed any ill will, nor have the people of Jim Thorpe. I know many of them. Joe Boyle, the gentleman in the mid-1950s who proposed this idea to Mrs. Thorpe, was one of the finest people I've ever known, and he unfortunately has passed away, and I would love to be able to talk to him, just to sit down and reason this out. There, in 1990, there was a federal repatriation and graves Indian Graves Protection Act. Mm-hmm. There are a number of legal avenues that are being looked at, but as you say, Basma, that there has never been any bad words thrown from either side. And I feel that if people knew what Jim's wishes were and what his spiritual belief, to me that takes it to a different realm when you talk about a person's religion, and that's what our appeal is. But you're absolutely right. There's never been any rancor or feelings of that nature expressed from either side through all this time.
Well, can I ask a couple of questions that I know that a lot of people may be concerned about? First of all, which state did he actually live in?
Bill?
Dad was born in Oklahoma.
But did he live in Oklahoma?
He lived in Oklahoma, but he also lived in various other states.
I see.
But his home was basically in Oklahoma.
And that's what he felt was home. To him.
Yes.
I know when the city, there were actually two cities that had agreed to join together to create
yes.
Jim Thorpe in the Poconos.
Yes.
And can I ask you, I know at the time, from my understanding and from your book and from the articles that I've read about this topic, is that they had hoped that somehow that it would help promote a healthier economic situation and more appeal to the actual city of Jim Thorpe.
Exactly. You
and has it done that?
Right. And that,
has it done
interestingly
that,
enough, that has not happened, nor did it ever happen. The town has enjoyed a tremendous rebirth. I think you may remember many years ago there was a number of Western movies actually shot in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, in Mauch Chunk, because it had fallen upon hard times, and they were hoping in the mid-50s to have some success and have some affluence brought about in a recovery on the shoulders of having Jim Thorpe's body and naming the town Jim Thorpe. But historically, even the most ardent supporters of not giving the body back will admit that tourism, because of having Jim Thorpe buried there or the name, didn't result in any upswing in the economy. In fact, when I visited there the first time, I was a senior in high school, and I endeavored to ask my parents to stop to see the name of this town called Jim Thorpe. And no one in the town would tell me why the town was called Jim Thorpe, or any information about where he was buried. And we spent 3 hours in the Evergreen Cemetery looking for a Thorpe headstone and finally gave up. My parents had to be to work the next day, living in Rochester, New York, about 300 miles away. Mm-hmm. And on top of one of the mountains of Basma you mentioned in the Poconos, I asked them to pull off to the side of the road, and I just had a feeling that something was out in this field. You couldn't see anything. There weren't any signs, but there was this big clump of grass and weeds, and they pulled off to the side. Thank goodness they did. We walked across the highway, and I parted these weeds, and there was this stone that had been greatly ravaged by hoodlums and had been defaced, but you could make out the writing on the stone, and it said, "Sir, you are the greatest athlete in the world, King Gustav V of Sweden." And on top of that, it said Jim Thorpe, 1888-1953. And on all four sides of the stone were engravings of an Indian, a baseball player, a football player, and a track and field athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I got home to the library in Rochester, New York, on fire to learn about this man, and there were no books written about him. And one historian, I wrote letters to the 10 top sports historians, one wrote back to me, and he said, "Beware, there have been more lies written about Jim Thorpe than any football player in history, including stories repeated by two Pulitzer Prize winners. So what an inspiration, what a cause that was presented to me. And I ended up hitchhiking 12,000 miles as a kid. I interviewed 200 people on tape who knew Jim, his family, his friends, his competitors, his adversaries, and submitted it for my master's thesis in Syracuse. But I just couldn't rest having told the true story, because I felt that he suffered the greatest injustice in sports history, and that was what you alluded to earlier about how his Olympic gold medals were taken away from him.
They were reinstated.
I was married, and my wife and I quit our jobs and dedicated ourselves to restoring his Olympic gold medals and his name to the Olympic record books.
Mm-hmm. Bob, this has become a labor of love for you.
Yes.
And do you mind me asking, did you ever meet him? You never met him in person, did you?
No, I never did, but ironically, I am the only one allowed access to his private papers by his widow, and the only one to interview her. And again, very ironically, she helped me set to rest a lot of the cruel stereotypes and the myths that were written about him that I highlight in my book. So I endeavored to leave no stone unturned. As I said, I talked to the man who for 40 years had resisted the restoration of his medals. That was my shortest interview. That one lasted 90 seconds, and I was told to turn my tape recorder off. But interestingly, no one turned me away from the interview. And even if it was Burt Lancaster in the middle of filming the Scalp Hunters with Telly Savalas and Ossie Davis and Shelley Winters, he totally shut down the production so that this young hitchhiker, namely me, would be given the time to talk to Burt Lancaster about. Interestingly enough, Jim was his hero. He played him, as you mentioned, in the movies, and Jim became his hero as well. In fact, he didn't want me to publicize this during his lifetime, Mr. Lancaster, but he paid Jim out of his own pocket to be his technical advisor for the film on his life.
Wow, that's a fascinating story.
Basma, is that universally people respected Jim Thorpe. They appreciated what he accomplished against insurmountable odds, and then secondly, they felt terrible about what happened to him with the injustice of taking his medals away and disgracing him and taking his name off the record books as if he had never competed. In fact, this is kind of breaking news. I just got a film from the 1912 Olympics from Stockholm, Sweden, the official repository, and the sections and the footage of Jim Thorpe competing have been cut out of the film.
Really?
So there's so much to talk about that it would take another hour.
So this story goes on and on. It's still a never-ending story.
Intransigence, the arrogance of the International Olympic Committee hierarchy was something to behold. But literally, thank God, my wife found a rule book that the Olympic people swore did not exist. And in that rule book was rule number 13 that says if you want to bring someone up on charges who competed in the Olympics, you had to do it within 30 days and pay 20 Swedish kroner. Well, they waited 6 months, and on that one technicality, which I said my wife found, and after she found it, she had spent the entire day in the private stacks of the Library of Congress, given special permission by their archivist, Dave Kelly, and she went through every book, every card catalog, found nothing, and then on an impulse, she dropped to one knee and reached behind the metal shelves behind one of the stacks, and she found this couple of pieces of paper on the floor, and she pulled it out, and it was this pamphlet, this little pamphlet from the 1912 Olympics, the rules and regulations, whereupon she sat down in the middle of the floor and just cried. And I took that one rule to William Simon, the executive director of the United States Olympic Committee, to Edward Bennett Williams, the famed lawyer who was the owner of the Redskins and the Orioles at the time. And they said, you've got a case, and you're going to win it because the International Olympic Committee broke their own rules. But that 90-second interview that I mentioned earlier, that was with Avery Brundage, the president of the International Olympic Committee. Mm-hmm. And when I asked him why he had resisted the restoration of Jim's honors for over 40 years, he said to me, son, you don't know your law very well, do you? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, ignorance is no excuse. So the great irony is when Flo, my wife, found that rule, we could respectfully say to the International Olympic Committee, ignorance is no excuse.
Did they ever issue any kind of an apology for that at all, Bob?
In 1983, they relented and gave them back.
But did they ever actually issue an apology?
Bill, do you remember an apology? I do not.
No, I don't recall an apology. Samarantz presented my sister Gail and myself the gold medals. But, I mean, it was just that he had been reinstated, and that was it. There was really no apology.
Can I ask you, gentlemen, does Jim's tribe in Oklahoma have any kind of legal standing, and can they make an argument on this matter in any way?
Bill, do you want to speak about that? They are doing that as we speak.
Yeah, they are doing that. They have their own tribal lawyer, and the tribal lawyer is the one that is doing this for the family and for the Sac and Fox tribe. I think the last reading that they had in court was that the two Thorpe children and the tribe have to be together in order to continue the program of getting Dad's body back.
Let me ask you, now your stepmother has long since passed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And was this argument ongoing when she was alive?
I think it was fairly close to the time that she actually passed, that my brother Carl, I believe Phil, was the first one that mentioned to the Olympic Committee, about getting Dad's reinstatement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you recall that or not, Bob.
I do, but Basma, were you asking about the body?
What I'm asking is that what is the current status of the actual Sac and Fox tribe in relation to this? And you said that there's a lawyer currently working on it?
Yes.
Stephen Ward is the attorney for the tribe and for Bill and his brother Richard.
And what measures do they have available to them in this case?
Well, it's currently in litigation in federal court in Pennsylvania, and I speak regularly with Mr. Ward, and he's indicating that he's anticipating before the end of this year some type of a decision or at least some type of a ruling to continue with the case, and that's when I spoke to him about getting the word out and possibly just creating a groundswell of support for this. It reminds me when I met with the Postmaster General when we were, again, trying to get support and people of importance in the government or whatever, and I said, mm-hmm. could we possibly get a Jim Thorpe stamp? And he was very kind and not arrogant at all, and he said, you are wasting your time because I get 6,000 requests a year for people wanting to honor their hero with a stamp. So at that point, I showed him the 3.5 million signatures that we had received from every service club you can imagine in the United States, as well as clubs throughout the world that had written in senior citizens, children, And when he saw those petitions, he said, I'm going to get you a stamp. And that's when they did that. And interestingly enough, 10 years later, another postmaster general who also thought Jim Thorpe was his hero, he also wanted a stamp. So now there are two stamps. But again, I think, according to Mr. Ward, the attorney, that our case, his case, Bill's case, the tribe's case, can be strengthened if we can get the word out to the people.
Let me ask you, Bob or Bill, I don't know who can answer. Does the cemetery laws come in play in any way? I know that, you know, obviously that outside of even just the rules, the regulations, and the laws of moving and disturbing the remains, I know that there are also spiritual consequences based on this. What are some of the issues that would surround this?
I don't think I'll take a stab at that first, Bill, if you want. I don't think. That's a very good question, but I do not think it comes into play because this is not in a cemetery. It's in a park-like setting, and I'm glad you mentioned that too, because again, Bill nor I have any intention of disparaging anyone. I described the way that the monument looked, or the stone looked, or the mausoleum, call it what you will, looked. That was back in the late '60s when I happened upon the town. Now there's the Jim Thorpe Vocational Technical School there. I've spoken there to the kids. They're outstanding students. The grounds are manicured. They've erected, very recently, they've erected two bronze statues, and they're erecting a third one. They have honored Jim, and they have not done anything to cheapen the setting. There's no souvenir stands. Again, I want to make it clear we have no criticism,
no animosity
of how they
towards
treated
the city itself.
Jim's body. It's just that our appeal is that they allow us to honor his wishes and those of his people. But I must repeat, they will admit that they have not profited from having Jim there. Their resurgence now is with their whitewater rafting and their very quaint and beautiful and historic city of bed and breakfast, and it's become a bit of a tourist mecca, but many writers have been there recently, and they stand there at the gravesite by themselves. There really is very little interest in tourists flocking to see his gravesite.
Okay. We have a question.
Also,
from,
I might mention that as far as Dad's body is concerned, I don't think there would be any religious, breaking any religion in taking his body and returning it to where he wanted to be buried. And also having a site at the Sac and Fox Indian Reservation itself is where we'll put his body if we get it back. We were going to put it in a cemetery that was out away from the city by a number of miles, and we found that the security and the chances of his body being, somebody getting in and doing damage to the site, if we put him on the Sac and Fox Indian Reservation itself, they'll have police patrols and things like that to protect it.
It will be a protected area. We have a question from Mike in California, gentlemen. It's a bit of a lengthy one. Actually, it's a twofold question. And I'm going to ask the question, and it's directed to Bill. And he says, could Bill speak about his father's real personality? In the film starring Burt Lancaster, Jim was portrayed as a very temperamental alcoholic person. And then he also asks, could Bob talk about Coach Pop Warner, hailed as the hero in American sports, but apparently a real villain in the whole scandals surrounding Thorpe and the mistreatment of natives at native schools? That's a tongue twister. Go ahead, Bill.
Good question.
Talk to us about your dad and the image that Burt Lancaster portrayed of him in the movie.
Well, Dad was actually a technical director on that movie, and so everything that was put into the movie had his approval. Like a lot of people, you can go through and pick out a lot of sportsmen, Babe Ruth, as an example of one, that after ball games and things like that, most of the people in those days would go out and celebrate their win or their loss. But Dad, he did. He enjoyed his beer and he enjoyed whiskey now and then also. But he was never a true alcoholic. A true alcoholic, would be that he was constantly intoxicated and never sober. Dad was sober many, many, many times. He took us fishing, he took us hunting and things like that. And so as far as his being an alcoholic, a total alcoholic, he was not. Also, as far as his personality and things like that, as I mentioned in the very beginning, he had happy-go-lucky, just enjoyed life and enjoyed people. He was a man's man and a woman's man. And so something that I think a lot of people will verify.
Well, it sounds like you have some very great memories of your dad.
I do. I think so.
I'm glad that's important. And Bob, Coach Pop Warner, hailed as a hero, but apparently a villain. Tell us all about him.
How much time do we have? No, I'm just kidding. Charles Bickford in the movie, boy, wouldn't you want him to play your grandfather or your father or a great guy? To cut right to the point, Basima, Jim was a student at Carlisle, as we've discussed. After the football season in 1909, Pop requested that Jim keep in shape over the summer, and actually it was the spring of 1909, headed toward the summer, and with Jesse Youngdeer and Joe Libby, whom I interviewed in his 90s, to verify what I had found and different documents that I had found in Jim's papers. Basically, their trusted coach, Pop Warner, at Carlisle, the football coach, also the track and field coach, said to the guys, I want you to keep in shape over the summer, and I have a friend in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And he called him Charlie Clancy, and Jim and his buddies went down there to play baseball for the summer. They were paid $2 a game, expense money, and again, if you were to look, this is where this gets very tricky and very specific and very legalistic. Legally, they were paid to play baseball if it were 2 cents a game, if that's the way you wanted to interpret the rules. But what I felt needed to be exposed was that Pop Warner never acknowledged he knew Jim had played summer ball. He never acknowledged this when he was chosen as an assistant coach on the Olympic team to scour the United States to find participants and team members for the 1912 Olympics. He knew Jim had played summer ball. He knew what the rules were. Interestingly enough, and this is important historically, Jim did not know. Jim used his own name. Of the hundreds of people I interviewed who played sports in Jim's day, many of them would tell story after story of how they would play football for a college on a Saturday, jump on a train. I went to Syracuse, for example, so the team would play a football game on Saturday afternoon in Archbold Stadium in Syracuse, and then shower, get dressed, and jump on a train for Philadelphia or Buffalo or Canton, as Bill said, and play for the Bulldogs or the Ben Franklin Yellow Jackets or the Chicago Bears or whatever, and they would change their names. The immortal Newt Rockne played as Mr. Jones, and the list goes on and on. And so the officials wanted to stop this, the college sports officials, and they just found the perfect patsy in Jim Thorpe. And the thing that I think is heartbreaking that's never been brought out is that Jim was an orphan at the time, a ward of the government, had a letter that had been sent him by President Taft praising him for being the highest type of American citizen, when ironically it would be 12 more years before Indians were granted citizenship. But through all of this, Jim was on his own, and Pop, according to Jim's children and his friends, went into Jim's apartment in Carlisle and took the medals and took the trophies and sent them back to the International Olympic Committee. So wow. Pop Warner in real life, as Burt Lancaster said, was R-E-E-L life, not R-E-A-L life.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. You know, I cannot believe that somebody as close to him could do something like that. That's amazing. Let me ask you, are there any... I know you mentioned a singer. Who was it that you mentioned that you had just spoken to?
Wayne Newton.
I'm sorry. Forgive me.
No, that's okay.
But do you have any other advocates that are advocating for your cause at this time?
We're just, as I said, my son is putting this together as we speak, and I anticipate if your listeners, I don't know what, since the website is not up yet, if it would be all right to give out my email address, but I think that this will carry a lot of weight when Bill was there with me when we met with Mr. Newton, and he got very emotional about that this man deserves to have his request at where he be buried. That should trump any law or any argument. And but to answer your question, Wayne is the first one with whom we've spoken. But when I put together with my wife the Jim Thorpe Foundation, we had the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and Robert Michael, the Republican whip, and we got basically put together 30 members of elected officials who sincerely and historically had fought for Indian rights, along with sports immortals and Olympic heroes, and I'm confident that this list will be amazing once we launch this website.
One of the things I think that, and I'm wondering, are you pursuing any sports heroes or people
Yes.
in the Olympic that have actually had problems with this?
Well, or, it's interesting you mention that because
or would like to
in
help
our original
to reinstate
board,
this in,
we
this.
Had Rafer Johnson and Bruce Jenner, two former gold medal winners in the decathlon.
Uh-huh.
And so I believe that there will be, again, once the word gets out, I believe there will be an enormous number of Olympic athletes who will come forward. And that's a very interesting point that you've raised too, Basma, that the hypocrisy, some of the rules, questionable rules over the decades, I think will play a part in motivating some people to come forward as well.
Well, I certainly hope so.
I must say that the creator of the modern Olympic movement, Baron de Coubertin, on his deathbed, lamented the way the Olympics had turned out in terms of being a playground for wealthy, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant boys. And he, that really broke his heart. And since in the last 10, 20 years, the last two decades, that has changed to a large degree where it's kind of an open competition now. But the circumstances, I think when they're brought to light about, isn't it ironic too, I'm thinking that Jim's life was beset by controversy and by hardship, and now 60 years after his death, The controversy still rages on, and I'm hoping that now, with the upcoming 100th anniversary of his Olympic triumph coming up next year, and he's been chosen as the role model for the 2012 Super Bowl in Indianapolis. A lot of people don't know that he was the first president of the National Football League and one of the co-founders.
Yeah, very interesting. We do have another question from George in Iowa, gentlemen. And this is kind of interesting, I guess. And George wants to know that since Jim Thorpe did not sell his body and he alone owned it, is there any leverage to annul the sale and simply return the body?
That's a great question. That sounds like something that I would love to propose to Mr. Ward.
I mean, yeah, it sounds like a rational thought to me. I mean, I guess I never thought about it, but he didn't sell his body, and if this was his wish prior to his death, and some, you know, I mean, really, what? That seems like some kind of there's some kind of logic to that.
I love that logic. I believe what the adversaries in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, would argue is that they have a signed contract from Mrs. Thorpe.
Yeah, but Jim didn't sign it.
It was possible that she may have sold his body.
Okay, but if he alone owned his body, I guess, can anybody else really? I mean, that's an ethical, moral question right there.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
I mean, I would certainly pursue something like that. George in Iowa, thank you very much. You've really stood in me and in all of us. I think that's just a fascinating concept.
It is.
You know, I mean, who can sell somebody else's body? I mean, I am the owner of me, and I am the owner of my body, whether I'm alive or dead. I own me.
Well, we sure appreciate this forum, Basma, because it's a tragic ending to, again, his spirit for all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
As George said, that's his body, and that was his wish. But his spirit will be forever roaming and forever not at peace in this situation. And I applaud Bill and his brother who are fighting so hard to honor their father's wish, and I'll do anything I can to facilitate that. And again, thank you for giving us this forum to get the word out. I think is going to be critical.
Well, I will tell you, gentlemen, that if and when the website is up, please notify our producers. We would be more than happy to add the website to the site under the links under this story. Because I think it's fascinating. I think that a travesty has been committed. And, you know, one of the things that, as I was reading, I got kind of interested in the dynamics behind this. And one of the things that was suggested, I can't even remember right now where I read it, but one of the things that was suggested was that, okay, they had his body for the 50 years that they've had it. It's been almost
right.
Half a century. They still have his legacy, the legacy of the story that he was buried there, the controversy, the original burial spot. What would be the harm in returning the body? Is there really that much of an attachment to his remains?
That is so beautifully stated.
What is the harm?
I would hope the answer to your question is no.
I mean, they have the history. They have the site. They have the legacy. They have the story and the controversy. Why not let his body and his remains rest in the land of his birth?
Yes.
I mean, to me, it just seems like the honorable thing to do. And I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that anybody has been dishonorable, but it would be the kind thing to do.
He wanted to be buried in Oklahoma.
Pardon me? Bill, you broke up a little bit.
Okay, I was just saying that as far as as far as Dad is concerned, his body, he wanted his body to be put to rest in Oklahoma.
Exactly. And the city of Jim Thorpe still has everything, including the name Jim Thorpe.
Yeah.
The bones, really? I mean, how much attachment is there to a city that probably doesn't even know half of what's going on about this?
You're absolutely right. And I hope and pray that will factor into the final decision.
Well, maybe we can have the community of the city of Jim Thorpe listen to our broadcast, and perhaps they'll see people over there, but can't see any harm in letting I among his people and ancestors. And that's what that. And anybody the Native American culture knows how deeply invested they are in their spiritual beginnings. But it is that time of the evening, folks. Gentlemen, I cannot tell you how fascinating a story this has been, how delightful you both are, how sorry we are for the longevity of this process. And we hope that one day we'll hear and have you back when his remains are returned to Oklahoma.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you again. And we will, when the website is up, we will get that information to you.
Please do that, Bob. We would appreciate it. We will attach it right to the site. And ladies and gentlemen, we will see you next week with Ellen Brown, president of the Public Banking Institute. Ellen will be talking about the Occupy Wall Street and her plan for statewide banking systems to save the economy of America. That's next week, November 8th, from 9 to 10 Eastern on the People Speak Radio. And don't ever forget, when the people speak, we make a difference. Thank you, gentlemen. You have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too,
it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Bye-bye.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.